Oh, yeah. Let's get out of our heads and into our hearts. All right. It's Michael Stone. This is Conversation. I fooled you. Played a new piece of music there. It is great to be back with you. Still rippling with the aftershocks of Copenhagen, which we're going to talk about today. One of the things I've discovered in coming back and talking to people is that there are some numbers that many people are not aware of that I think are important numbers. I want to spend a few minutes talking about some of the basics of climate change and the science of it. And as Bill McKibben likes to say, there's three numbers that we need to really understand to understand global warming. Those are 275, 389, and 350. Throughout all of history, until about 300 years ago, the atmosphere contained 275 parts per million of carbon dioxide. That's a useful amount to know. With some other greenhouse gases that trap heat in our atmosphere, our planet would be too cold for life on Earth if it weren't for having that. That's just part of the natural cycle, and for a very long time we've had relatively stable temperatures up until the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And this whole science is not something new. It was first really talked about in the early 1800s, I think 1824. They were talking about the gases and how they would increase the temperature, but nobody knew whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. It was further proven in the late 1800s. And then in the 50s and 60s, it really became to be clear that there was a problem as these numbers started to go up. When we started burning coal and oil to produce energy and consumer goods, so it started to rise. These numbers started to rise. And we're now at 389 parts per million of carbon dioxide. The easiest way to think about carbon dioxide is that a tree is a wet carbon stick, let's say. And if you cut that tree down and either burn it or it decomposes, it turns into carbon dioxide, which is primarily one of the gases that's keeping the heat in. So we're trying to keep the level down to a place that can keep the temperature, the global temperature, under 2 degrees, and most people think under 1.5 degrees centigrade. That's what this number is. It's very hard to relate the number, but that's the number that many of the scientists have come up in, and that's Bill McKibben started the 350.org to keep those numbers down. We don't know that that's the exact number, but the idea is how do we keep the temperature from going above the average normal temperature before the industrial age to more than 1.5 or 2.0 centigrade at this particular time. That's that number. So 275 is the number where we were at the beginning of coal pollution, and you can bring in all kinds of things and look at sunspots and different things, but they follow a very natural pattern. Until we start burning coal and oil and gas, that's when the temperature line starts going up and all things get really wacky. So it's pretty clear science there. And one of the things that's important to know is that the amount of trees that we cut down each year contribute to between 17 and 20% of the carbon dioxide buildup. If you think about it, there's really two things that need to happen. One is that you need to quit cutting the trees down. And two is we need to keep the fossil fuel in the ground. We're looking for all these new ways of finding deposits of gas and oil. And we've got many ways of creating different things, which I talked to George Monbiot in a later interview about. But the reality is that if we use even 60% of what we already know about these reserves, we are in big trouble. So somehow we have to figure out how to keep a lot of these into the ground. Here's an interview with Bill McKibben.
Bill McKibben, welcome to Conversations.
It's good to be with you.
It's great to be with you, too. I've been following your work for a long time and so appreciate it. Let's start out by telling our listeners a little bit about 350.org and the history and then what's happening here in Copenhagen.
Sure. Look, you got to start with the science. That's where all conversations about climate change need to begin and end. 350 is the most important number in the world. We didn't know it 2 years ago until American scientists led by Jim Hansen at NASA produced a series of papers showing that 350 parts per million CO2 was the most we could safely have in the atmosphere if, as they said in the abstract of one of those papers, we wanted a planet similar to the one on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. That's strong language. It's stronger language still when you know that we're well past 350 already. We're at 390 parts per million and continuing to rise 2 parts per million per year. That's why the Arctic is melting. That's why the American Southwest is in an epic drought. That's why Australia is on fire. That's why seawater is turning acid, on and on and on. Were we to stop burning fossil fuel over a period of time, the CO2 level of the atmosphere would begin to drop. Mm-hmm. The youngest people on the planet now would be old people before we got back to 350. Damage will be done in the meantime. We're not going to stop global warming. But if we act very, very quickly and very, very dramatically, then there's a chance we can keep it from getting entirely out of control and passing many more tipping points. We've already melted the Arctic. That one looks pretty much done. But we've got to take that warning and do everything we can to put on the brakes.
And the recent news from Greenland is very discouraging also.
There's no shortage of sobering news. If you read Nature or Science, the two big periodicals each week, then each week you get a new dose of information, each of it indicating that it's worse than we thought.
A new dose of reality. What about the reality here in Copenhagen at COP15?
Well, the reality here, of course, is that as we get towards the end, naked power is doing its best to assert itself. The U.S. and a few other great powers are trying to dictate the terms of some agreement. The agreement they're trying to dictate is weak to the point almost of uselessness. The computer jockeys running the numbers said last night that if you add up all the proposals that have been put forward, it yields a world in the year 2100 with an atmospheric concentration of 770 parts per million CO2. That's if that's not hell, then it has a remarkably similar temperature. So that agreement would be a bad thing. There have been remarkable efforts by the smallest countries in the world to stand up to that. They've had, for the first time, the backing of a big global movement, 350.org, thanks to many of your listeners and people like them all over the planet, in October conducted what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history, with 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries demanding fidelity to that 350 target. That's been enough to really help the small countries withstand some of the pressure from the big ones. These are the countries that face the most imminent threats to their survival: drought-stricken African nations, low-lying island nations, high mountain nations whose glaciers are melting quickly. They'll probably have to cave in the next couple of days in the face of all that economic might that the developed world represents. But it's been good to see them put up a fight. This process will obviously have to go forward for the next year. We'll continue to try to build that movement and push for real change.
One of the things that seems to be an emerging possibility is the people's voice that is being catalyzed here in Copenhagen. Tell us a little bit about the next 7 months or so leading up to Mexico City. What's happening in your life?
God only knows. We'll see what happens as the dust settles from here. We've got a huge global network at 350.org. We will put it to work in the year ahead. But we're going to have to be savvy about figuring out how that, what happens and how it works.
Yeah.
Because it's extremely difficult to figure out how to beat power this big and this rich.
One of the things to me that's most inspiring about your organization, and of course it started, I guess,
from you in Middlebury College, but is the young people.
Yes.
And the power of the voice and the incredibly innovative ideas and solutions that should be being listened to. Do you feel that their voice is being heard? And talk about some of the things you see them doing that are working.
Well, in official circles, of course, young people just patronized and patted on the head and sent out of the room while the adults do the real work. That's what's going on over at the conference. I tend not to think that much about the age of the people we work with. They are mostly young. Partly that's because most people around the world are young, given the demographics of this planet. But they do have a particular set of talents. One is a visceral sense of how the wired world works. They grew up with the web. They know how to. They know both its possibilities and its limitations. And so we're able to use electronic means very effectively to enable things to happen in the real world on the ground, which is still where things need to happen. So I greatly like working with the young people we work with, but I don't think of them as young people. They run our organization. They're just colleagues.
Just in bringing to a close, let's talk to some of our listeners about what's at stake and about what they can do about it, because I think people feel a little overwhelmed by the entire process and what's happening. How can people make a difference?
Well, in the next day or two, you know, they can make a difference by letting our leaders know that we want a strong text. It's not going to win the day necessarily, but it's very useful to register that sense. If you go to 350.org, we've got a tool up on the website that'll tell you just how to be in touch with people around the U.S. government who at these negotiations and register your sense of things. But in the slightly longer run, we need more organizing in more places to build this movement ever larger. 350.org, for whatever reason, has emerged as the biggest vehicle for doing that. And so people are invited to come help us or to figure out other ways. I think that the key thing, the reason that we've been successful is because we have a very simple message that allows it to break through the din, concentrated very much on the physics and chemistry of this problem in an understandable way that unites people around the world. And so that's what we'll keep doing.
I noticed a lot of attention here shifted from the parts per million to the temperature. And I think that's something that more people are listening to. Are you corresponding this to the
Oh, yes, both of them. It's the 1.5 degrees Celsius and 350 parts per million. They're more or less. The problem with temperature targets is just that we really have no very good idea of how much carbon produces what temperature.
Yeah.
What we know is how much carbon the world can deal with because we have long geological record to give us some sense.
Great. Any last words before we close?
No, just thanks to everybody who's been helping us at 350.org, and there have been many in your area. It's going to be a continuing battle.
Yeah. Well, Bill McKibben, I just want you to know for all of our listeners, thank you for the tireless work, and hopefully we can cut down on your carbon footprint a little bit by getting more technology
That's
in
it.
Your back room.
That's it. Thank you guys very, very much.
Take care.
All right.
All right, Bill. And that was Bill McKibben. He's an American environmentalist, a writer. He actually wrote 30 years ago, The End of Nature, and he's been the head of 350.org, an international climate change movement, which has grown quite large. In fact, he just finished in October the largest civil demonstration against global warming, probably against most anything in all history, with some, I think it was 8,200 demonstrations in 193 countries. So quite an amazing and powerful man and organization and incredible group of people working at 350.org. I highly recommend looking them up
on internet350.org, in fact. The next person that I'd like to share with you is George Monbiot. He's a journalist. He's the author. His latest book is called Heat. It's a must-read for anybody serious about understanding global warming. He's an academic, and he's a political writer, writes for the Guardian newspaper in the UK. He's on the advisory board of BBC Wildlife magazine, and I would like to just share a little bit of George with you. George Monbiot, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here in this insane place here where many of the NGOs and people who should be in there having their voice heard aren't, including yours. Let's talk about the weather. From all the way back to the beginning of time, we've had five mass extinctions, and then we had a stable period for a long time. Then we had the Industrial Revolution. And let's talk about how that's changed since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution to now, and why people are trying to get back to under 350 parts per million of CO2.
Yes, well, carbon dioxide is the main greenhouse gas, and what a greenhouse gas is a gas which prevents infrared radiation, in other words, heat, from escaping from the world's atmosphere. And even very small quantities have a very powerful effect in that respect. What's happened is that we have raised the levels of carbon dioxide by 30% or so. It's gone from 280 parts per million before industrialization to about 385 parts per million today. And that's a huge increase in percentage terms, but it's not nearly as big as we're likely to have the rest of this century unless very drastic action is taken to prevent further greenhouse gas emissions. And as those greenhouse gases build up in the atmosphere, global temperatures rise, and they've already risen by about 0.7 degrees centigrade. And the prospect is that they are likely to rise between about 2 and 6 degrees centigrade this century, which might not sound like very much, but don't forget that the difference between the last ice age and today is just 4 degrees.
That's the total difference.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
new. I didn't know that.
And so we're talking about creating a totally new habitat on Earth, a totally different ecosystem, world ecosystem, a different biosphere. And that's a biosphere to which humankind has not adapted. You know, human beings have adapted to suit a very particular set of climatic circumstances. Our population has risen very sharply as a result of being able to prosper and thrive in that particular climate, and we've been able to populate lots of parts of the world which under different climates we would not have been able to populate.
Well, not only different climates, but also the advent of fossil fuel and the Green Revolution too,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely, and the fossil fuel has given us an incredible ability to inhabit places which previously we couldn't have inhabited and to enhance our general prosperity as well. But the downside, obviously, is that it's producing carbon pollution, which will make some of the places we've been able to inhabit because of this very kind climate that we have at the moment, it will make them uninhabitable because there won't be enough rainfall in those places, for example, or the sea level will rise. Now, you know, we've seen throughout history, throughout prehistory, through natural fluctuations, significant shifts in the climate, sometimes by as much as 6 degrees centigrade in a very short period of time. And those shifts have always been accompanied by a complete ecological catastrophe.
Right.
So, for instance, at the end of the Permian period, 250 million years ago, there was about 6 degrees of warming. And almost all species on Earth were wiped out, well over 90 to 95% on land and even more perhaps in the oceans. Almost all the large vertebrates, the large animals with backbones, were wiped out, and the reptile species were dominated pretty well by just one species around the world, which happened to be well adapted to the completely new environment that was created. And, you know, we are a species which has adapted to a particular set of climatic circumstances. Now, some of us will still be able to find that set of climatic circumstances, just as in the Ice Age, lots of parts of the world became uninhabitable to humans, and humans moved towards the tropics, and they were able to find places which they could live in. But the trouble is, you know, then there were a few tens of thousands of people on Earth. Yeah. Today, there are nearly 7 billion people on Earth, and many of those people have got nowhere to move to. And if large parts of the Earth's surface become uninhabitable, where do they go? What happens to those people?
I think the estimate for environmental refugees in the next 30 years is something like over a billion of environmental refugees. Is that...
Well, whether people move or stay, their lives are going to become very difficult indeed. Mm-hmm. And and many people will try to stay on because people don't want to lose their land, but they will find their subsistence decreasing and decreasing. And if they aren't able to move off, they will become more malnourished, and in fact, many of them are quite likely to die.
Now, let's put it in perspective of the COP15 proceedings that are going on. From what I understand, if we do absolutely nothing, we'll hit something like 5.5 degrees. If we do what they're saying in all the proceedings right now, it'll be 4.5 degrees, which is, again, uninhabitable, and we have very little time to shift. What are your thoughts about what's happening at the COP15, and what are the issues that we should be paying attention to?
Mm. Well, it's very clear that that with the exception of some of the least developed countries, there is no general discussion about what the science says. Mm. We in the rich world have paid hundreds of millions of dollars for the best science money can buy. We've funded climate science to try and find out what on earth is going on and what's likely to happen. And yet it's been left to the poor countries to tell us what our own scientists have been saying.
Right.
Because rich nations have ignored their advice and are negotiating from a position which isn't informed by the science at all.
Well, of course, you talk about the hundreds of millions that's been spent on the climate and science doesn't compare much to the billions that have been spent by, in our country, the coal, gas, and oil industry, disinformation industry.
Really. That's right. And, of course, you know, that's not spending it on trying to make people better informed. That's spending money on trying to make people worse informed.
Exactly.
And the denial industry is a very big one indeed. And we know of large amounts of money sloshing into it, but there's got to be much, much more we don't know of, because it just happens we have the annual accounts of certain companies like ExxonMobil, which show that they've been paying large amounts of money to people who deny that climate change is taking place. But we haven't been able to see the accounts of the coal companies and many of these other players who fund this extremely well-financed and well-organized industry.
Now, one of the things you said the other day that definitely caught my attention, and I think everyone there, is that the delegates are not serious, and you had a very good reason why. Can you talk about that?
Yes. The delegates aren't serious because they only have a demand-side policy for dealing with climate change. And what that means is that they're all trying to get us to reduce our demand for carbon-based energy. And they say we should change our light bulbs and buy more efficient cars and insulate our lofts and use renewable energy rather than fossil fuel energy and all the rest of it. They're all demand-side policies for reducing our consumption of carbon. Well, that's fine. That's great. But all of them, every nation on Earth which has any reserves, with the possible exception of one, have got the opposite policy when it comes to supply. That is to maximize the production of coal, oil, and gas. And the two policies cannot be reconciled. The only one which has a slightly different policy is, believe it or not, Saudi Arabia, which where King Abdullah has said that oil in the ground is worth more than money in the bank. Mm. And so they want to leave some of their oil in the ground to sell at higher prices later. But with that exception, everybody is just going hell for leather to get as much fossil fuel out of the ground as they can. Now,
well, Ecuador is Plan Verde.
Well, that's true, actually. Yeah. You are right. So thanks for correcting me there. Ecuador is the exception there. But so unless there is a global policy for leaving fossil fuel in the ground, two things happen. First of all, the supply-side policy undermines the demand-side policy. The carbon price stays low, so it is not attractive to invest in renewables. Secondly, we inevitably breach the 2 degrees limit, because there's some very important papers published in the journal Nature earlier this year show you can burn an absolute maximum of 60% of current fossil fuel reserves without breaching 2 degrees.
We have to figure out how to leave 40% in the ground
as an
absolute minimum, and that's at 2 degrees, which is an iffy number anyway.
Yes.
And on top of that, it doesn't take into account the tar sands and the gasification and all these unconventional, can you talk a little bit about the unconventional methods?
Yes. That is simply conventional reserves of coal, oil, and gas. Now, a reserve is only part of the resource. The resource is everything in the Earth's crust. The reserve is that part of the resource that's good to go. In other words, it's been prospected, it's been identified and measured, where the technology exists to extract it, and it's economically viable to extract. So that's the takeaway part of the total resource. And it's just those reserves of coal, oil, and gas, the ones which are good to go, we can use a maximum of 60% of those. But, of course, at the same time, companies are developing a whole load of unconventional fuels, like the tar sands in Canada, some of the dirtiest fuels on Earth, oil shale, or emulsion, different kinds of bitumen around the world. All of these make petroleum, crude oil, look green because they are so dirty and so polluting.
Yeah.
And so that means you can use much less than 60% of the total amount of fossil fuels which is ready to go, because you've got to add the unconventionals to the conventional ones. But the calculations of how much carbon is in the unconventionals is too complicated for me to do, so I can't work out what the total percentage needs to be. And it's amazing that no government is even attempting to do that. You know, there's been no research on this at all, apart from those two papers.
That was the first I heard of it when you said it.
Yeah, you know, there are those two papers in Nature, but no government has taken that forward to say, aha, if that's the case, what are our policies going to be? Well, the obvious two policies is, one, you start identifying that part of the reserve which you're going to leave in the ground, mm-hmm. and two, you impose a global moratorium on new prospecting.
Yeah.
That's so obvious. It's so obvious that if you're serious about preventing more than 2 degrees of warming, that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
And that's why I say that none of the governments meeting in Copenhagen are serious about preventing 2 degrees of warming.
Right. Then on top of that, we've got the process, which seems to be at this point being dictated primarily by the United States and China, even the whole way of doing the proceedings and now locking out a lot of the people's voices in the NGOs. What are your thoughts about where we're going and what we can expect to come out of this?
Well, it's back to the old 19th century opaque diplomacy done between a few grandees with everybody else shut out of the picture. This is completely the wrong way to go at it. Completely the wrong way to go at it. There has been no strategy at Copenhagen, amazingly, for engaging civil society in these discussions. And it's just, I mean, it really is the old 19th century model where a load of blokes with big moustaches would sit round a table and carve up the world between them.
Yeah.
Now, you might have thought, with the tremendous upsurge of participatory democracy coming from the grassroots, that we would have got beyond that model a little bit by now, mm-hmm. 150 years after that sort of colonialist model of deciding what happens in the world. Mm-hmm. Not a bit of it. Far from it. They have gone to much further lengths than any previous climate talks at shutting people out here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has been a revolting process. And here I am. Came to Copenhagen to participate as best I could, to talk to people and the rest, and I haven't been able to get into the conference centre the whole time. What's really galling is you see these climate change deniers in there, in the media rooms, just scoring hit after hit, and I can't get at them. I can't go and argue with them.
Yeah, it is. That must be really frustrating for you. So many people feel that they don't make a difference. And what are your thoughts about what somebody can do to actually make a difference in this issue?
Mm. In one respect, we are the most privileged generation that has ever existed, because we are the only people now who can make the difference as far as the biggest issue that humanity has ever encountered is concerned. Our forebears couldn't do it because they didn't have enough knowledge. They didn't realize what they were getting into. And our descendants won't be able to do it because it'll be too late. And so it's just us. It's just these generations which are on Earth today who can make the running and can change the way the world runs to the extent that we determine whether or not human life is going to continue in many parts of the world. This is the biggest crisis humanity has ever faced. And so we are in this unique, privileged position where we can actually respond to the crisis. We're the only people who can, the only people who ever will be able to. And if we don't respond to it, that is the greatest abnegation of human responsibility there's ever been. But we have to be smart in the way we respond. And what we need to do is to get far more people mobilized and involved in the campaign than we've seen so far. It surprises me how few people have become active climate change campaigners so far. It's rising very rapidly, but not rapidly enough. We need to make a set of very clear demands. At the moment, we have a whole load of disparate demands firing off in all different directions. And in my view, there's a very, very simple demand: leave fossil fuels in the ground, which is...
And don't cut down the trees.
And don't cut down the trees, exactly. Yes. Those are the two complementary policies.
Leave fossil fuels in the ground,
don't cut down the trees. Now, that... Who can argue with that as a policy for climate change? That is the only thing which ultimately makes sense. And if you're not aiming to do that, and I'm glad you added that bit, because of course those are the two sides of the same policy. If you're not aiming to do that, you are not aiming to curtail climate change.
Well, George Monbiot, it's great to have you on Conversations, and I appreciate the work you've been doing for many years, and I know you will continue to do that.
Thank you so much, very much indeed, Michael. That's my pleasure.
That was George Monbiot. One of the things that I haven't talked too much about, and the next person I'm going to play addresses it, and that's the whole carbon trading scheme. Vandana Shiva is a physicist. She's a philosopher. She's a leader in the global agriculture movement. She's known as one of the most eloquent speakers who has been a stand for people's rights. She's directing an international movement on food rights. She established Navdanya, which is a biodiversity conservation and farmers' rights organization. I have to tell you that this was one of the thrills for me of being at the conference. I've wanted to interview her for years and to sit in the same room with one of the great minds and great leaders on this planet was just an amazing privilege. This is Vandana Shiva.
Welcome to Conversations, Dr. Shiva. It's great to have you here. I'd like to start with your mentioning today about and expanding on the idea of false climate solutions. Could you speak to that for our listeners?
Ever since the climate treaty was brought into force, actually the world has been given false climate solutions. The Kyoto Protocol was based on emissions trading. In effect, it was about polluters continuing to pollute and making money out of it. So we've just had the story of how ArcelorMittal, the biggest steel company of the world, has walked away with £1 billion in terms of carbon credits. More rights to pollute were allocated than they actually pollute. And if the value of carbon, as they talk in the market language, goes up to the 30 euros that the Europeans are talking about, the 1 billion will be 3 billion. Emissions have not come down. They've increased by 16%. The Kyoto Protocol had a target of 5% reduction. Quite clearly, these instruments are failing. And even while the old instruments are failing, new false solutions are being tabled. Nuclear energy has reincarnated itself as clean energy. The US and India had a nuclear deal in the name of clean energy solutions. The entire nuclear lobby is here at COP15, trying to push nuclear as a solution. Coal, knowing very much that fossil fuel are at the heart of the problem, have suddenly called themselves clean coal. And are talking about sequestering carbon by putting the carbon dioxide into where? They don't know. By 2012, they say they'll have some experimental stations put together. We have had reports from all parts of the world of how suddenly carbon dioxide building up underground has created huge eruptions, some lakes in Africa, etc. They haven't even looked at the safety of those aspects. You can't continue to burn fossil fuel, generate carbon dioxide beyond the planet's capacity to absorb, and think somehow you can take the same earth and bury this waste into her. Other false solutions, biofuels. The idea that now that fossil fuel is running out, let's turn the food and plants of this planet into running our cars. This is a negative energy solution. It uses more fossil fuel to produce biofuels, and it is at the root of the growing hunger crisis, because as corn and soya start to get diverted to make biofuel, people won't have food. A new solution that is being tabled is genetically modified crops as the climate solution. Roundup Ready crops are known to have created huge damages. They've destroyed biodiversity. They've actually destroyed the ability of the planet to create carbon, to return to the soil. And yet they're talking about being a conservation tillage system that maximizes carbon return. I've done research on this. And carbon is decreasing, not increasing, in Roundup Ready soils. Biochar, another false solution. When the biofuel industry got caught in creating the hunger crisis, they decided, oh, let's turn our waste into the thing we'll sell as a climate solution. The waste out of biofuels is a charcoal. They call it an elegant name called biochar. And then link it to a 10,000-year-old Amazonian civilization that had terra prata. This is not terra prata. This is just charcoal and industrial waste. And I can see if this gets into the negotiations, every industry, from the sugar industry to the power industry, the steel industry, will take all its crappy black waste and repackage it as biochar and poison our remaining soils and kill the earth. So we have to be extremely vigilant. And I think the time has come to not let solutions rise from corrupt international governments, but from people committing themselves to the earth.
So let's talk about democracy then, the difference between a corporate democracy and an earth democracy. How do you see that? And how do you see it emerging?
Well, a corporate democracy is no more a democracy. A corporate democracy takes democracies that were supposed to be by the people, for the people, of the people, and turns it into dictatorships through the states, by the corporations, of the corporations, for the corporations. In India, we witness what this does. As steel plants and aluminium plants move to India and are shut down in Europe and America because it's costly to produce steel, it's costly to pay the workers a full living wage. Steel workers and metal workers are, after all, some of the best organized labor unions. To escape those labor unions, the companies are having partnerships, moving to countries like India. But there they've declared a war against the tribals. And as the tribals resist and say, but this land is our ancestral land, the Constitution gives us a guarantee that we will be the ones who decide what we do with this land. When the corporations want that land for the mines and the minerals under it, they will then use the paramilitary forces of the state to shoot and kill. A genocide is taking place in India. Most of the world doesn't realize it. A corporate dictatorship based on this limitless greed for the resources of the people must annihilate not just the earth, but the human rights of peasants and indigenous people. An earth democracy recognizes that the earth has her own rights. All species are part of an earth family. And earth democracy has to be practiced on the ground by people in their everyday lives. That practice means that actions are taken in ways that minimize harm. Because local people will never damage themselves. A local person will not contaminate their own water source because they know tomorrow too they have to drink for it. A paper mill can throw its waste into a river. So when responsibility and rights are merged, and the very beginning of why we do what we do is inspired by the idea of us being part of this amazing earth family and the relationships we have with all beings, you start to live in different ways.
Yeah. Do you have a question, Dr. Hagee?
I was really wanting to know more about women's role in all of this. I can see that in India, maybe women are standing up more for the soil and the family and so on.
Yeah, would it be nice if you were here in the last interview, because that's exactly what she did. But yeah, but you know, the reason women are rising is because women were left by the division of labor to look after the sustenance of society. It was assumed that men can be pulled out of the society and be sent to plantations to run industries and factory. Women were left to provide the water, to provide the food, to look after children. So women continued to participate in a care economy. And in the care economy, they've managed to maintain the values of caring for nature, for community, for their families. So when the forests go, women of Chipko come out and hug the trees and say, you have to kill us before you kill the trees. When the Bhopal disaster happens and kills 3,000 people in one night and 30,000 since then, is the victims of Bhopal, the women of Bhopal, who are still 25 years later fighting for justice. When Coca-Cola, whose posters are all over the airport, when you get off the flight, you see Copenhagen and then the bottle of Coke, hope in a bottle of Coke. Well, the women of Plachimada don't think that, because in Plachimada, Coke was exploiting groundwater at the rate of 1.5 to 2 million liters per day and had left a water famine. Women had no water in their wells because groundwater is connected. My well is connected to your well. Coca-Cola's well is connected to the village wells. And then a woman called Mai Lama, who's no more, she passed away 2 years ago, she said, why should we keep walking further for water? This company has to shut down. And they had the courage to organize actions. They invited me to celebrate 1 year of resistance. And then I realized 500 policemen, 100 women. This was a very unequal struggle. And we put all our weight behind the women's struggle of Plachimada. Coca-Cola had to shut down.
Would you talk a little bit about your hopes and your expectations of what we can have come out of COP15, what your expectations are?
Well, you know, expectation is a realistic assessment. Mm-hmm. And a realistic assessment tells me that there are only two outcomes of the formal meetings of Copenhagen. If the big powers win, then we will have a dismantling of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which means a retreat pre-1992, before the Earth Summit in Rio, a free-for-all for the global corporations that are destroying the climate, no internationally binding instrument to regulate them, and so-called voluntary measures by national governments designed to continue the allow the corporations to pollute. That is exactly what the U.S. administration is trying, and unfortunately and sadly even under Obama leadership. And all this declaration of 16% reduction, which is really 4% reduction measured on 1990 levels, is not a reduction at all. But the main agenda of the U.S. is dismantle the United Nations binding treaty. And they want to have a political declaration. A political declaration counts for nothing. It's empty. We need a legally binding treaty. If the third world wins out, the weaker countries which are facing the intensity of climate impact, the small island nations, Africa with its increasing droughts, if they win out, the only one way the weak have an instrument in the face of injustice, and that is to not cooperate. That's what Gandhi told us.
Yes.
About Satyagraha. So a victory of Satyagraha would be, in my view, a better outcome than an agreement that is a negative agreement to destroy the basis of an internationally binding treaty. What's my hope? My hope is that the Satyagraha takes place. We brought down the British Empire through Satyagraha. And the only way we can bring down the corporate empire is through a Satyagraha of governments as well as people. The movements here at Climate Forum or at Christiana are saying we do not believe in your corporate solutions, where you take every crisis the corporations have created and hand it over to corporations and said, make more money out of the crisis you created. Everyone has had enough of this. They're assuming the world is foolish and stupid. They're assuming the world is blind and deaf. And the arrogance of these big powers is what is at test here in Copenhagen.
Can you talk a little bit about, of course, food security being the highest issue, but also the 200,000 Indian farmers who committed suicide and, you know, the loss of hope there and how to regain that?
Well, you know, the current industrial globalized food system is a system based on war. The chemicals that come into chemical farming came out of war. They weren't designed for agriculture. Pesticides are war chemicals. Herbicides are war chemicals. Genetic engineering is based on war technology. You shoot with a gene gun. Why on earth would you do that? Instead of doing loving breeding, treating every crop and every species as having a subjecthood and having an integrity. But this turns into a war against people. In terms of farmers, because India is a poor country, Indian farmers don't have the rate of subsidies that European and American farmers have. where $400 billion of subsidies are given that allows these corporations to sell the rubbish. In India, the farmer has to bear the burden. So when Monsanto comes in with GM seeds for cotton, the prices rise from 7 rupees to 1,700 rupees. Pesticide use goes up 13-fold. Farmers' debt goes beyond the level of their repayment. And that is why they're committing suicide, because they were made to believe that this was going to make them prosperous. Where is the source of hope in all of this? The source of hope is in what we try and do through Navdanya. When the suicide of 200,000 farmers is all in the period after 1997. Most of these suicides are concentrated in the BT cotton, GMO cotton belt. And so I did a seed pilgrimage to these areas to find out why are the farmers so trapped. And I realized what the companies had done is make the farmers destroy their old seed. It's called seed replacement. Before they sell, they make sure the farmer doesn't have alternative. So we started to save seeds and distribute seeds. Then we helped farmers go organic. We helped train them in organic. And then we helped build up their markets for an organic cotton. The farmers are earning 10 times more through the organic route. That is where the hope lies.
One more thing I'd like to ask you about that people don't talk about a lot, though, is the whole issue of population, of course, which is a huge variable. You don't hear too much talked about any kind of population control or the relationship to that. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I've written a whole section on this on my book on Earth Democracy. Because when it comes to problems like climate change, which is linked to fossil fuel use, the poor of the world have really had no contribution. I mean, in the villages in India where I work very closely with farmers, you can find village after village with not one element of fossil fuels in it. Yeah. They live in a biodiversity economy. So you can't then implicate them in the climate problem. The second issue is that populations don't just grow. Populations grow under periods of economic insecurity. And population growth is a defense when security has been taken away from you. The two areas where population growth can be measured on this terms is the Scotland clearances. The Highland clearances of Scotland led to a population explosion. When the farmers were removed from the land so that sheep could graze for wool for the emerging textile industry, the displaced people had a rising population. In India, after the 1850s, when the British took control of the Indian economy, started to change the land tenure, robbed the peasants of their land, and put in their place these giant landlords to collect revenues, you had a population growth. Yeah. And Mehmood Mamdani, who's a professor at Columbia, did a very, very good study. He asked Punjab peasants who had large families, he said, why do you have such a large family? Why do you have 5 kids? The landlord only has 2. And this landless peasant said, the landlord can get the next tractor. I can only have the next child.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, there seems to be also a direct relationship between the infant mortality rates and the rise in population. Like, yeah. Okay, how many of my children
exactly.
will actually live?
When I talked about insecurity, that's the issue.
Yeah.
That when you are pushed into deep insecurity with infant mortality, with no guarantee of what your tomorrow will be, more children are a better option for the poor than less children.
If you had 3 things that you could tell our listeners that they could do today to help turn things around and move towards a more earth-friendly democracy, what would that be?
The first thing would definitely be, if you're a farmer, go organic. If you're not a farmer, you're definitely an eater. Find a farmer who's organic and make a relationship. Mm-hmm. The second is, stop thinking you are isolated and an atom in society. Build and strengthen your relationships wherever you can, in family, with your neighbors, in your workplace, because community is our strength. Community provides the alternative. And the third is, at the time when the Walmarts have taken over a large part of the world and Wall Street is collapsing, don't put your faith in Wall Street. Put your faith
or
in
your
the
dollars,
earth.
Right?
Or your dollars. Put your faith in the earth.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
That was Vandana Shiva, Indian philosopher, writer, and very powerful leader, as I'm sure you can hear. Well, we're already running out of time. I first of all want to thank you. So many calls today, and it really touches me deeply to see that there are so many people who deeply care
about what happens. I remember being in the Bella Center, some of the images in there, the crowds of people when the NGOs were thrown out, and people from countries all around the world crowded into this Klima Forum on the other side of town, really the People's Forum. And one day I was there, and this whole line of about 55 and 6-year-olds with just shiny faces and unbounded exuberance started filing through. They were actually going to the pool area in this area, but I just looked at them, and I have to say I burst into tears knowing that they're the ones who are going to have to deal with the mess that we're leaving behind. And, you know, there's something very positive that can come out of all this. In fact, if I look at the conference itself, in spite of the fact, and I have so many more things to say about this, but in spite of the fact that from a political or getting an agreement amongst nations and political institutions, it's really going to be left to us, the people, to stand up, as Vandana Shiva says. And if you look at this, there were 119 heads of state meeting over a concern about climate change. They weren't debating about whether there was climate change or anything like that. They were clear about that, but they were focusing a lot on how to do it financially without hurting the economies. Well, there is no economy on a dead planet, as someone has said. But there's also a coalescing of the largest global people's movement in history. And I think that's really important to recognize, that we are not alone. There are people all over the world, including China, which was really, and I'd love to have more time to talk about China, but I'm not going to. But the final stop in the negotiations was China. Maybe another show I can talk about that more. Another thing that really gave me hope was the global youth movement. They are so smart, so vital, so on top of it. They understand the issues. They know how to mobilize large groups of people through technology and innovation, and they have unbounded energy. That was really, for me, one of the highlights of the conference. The awakening of the global public to the reality of the issue in the face of the climate denials industry. And by the way, in several weeks, I'm going to have James Hogan on, who wrote Climate Cover Up. And it's pretty shocking, but follow the money, and you get a real good view of why people are confused about climate change. So while there wasn't a legally binding target, and what was talked about was way short of what's needed, the conference did come up with a political agreement to cap the temperature at 2 degrees and to review it to 1.5 degrees centigrade. It's a start. A lot's going to happen between now and COP16 in Mexico next December. So it's a long way to go, but it's a start. And that's about all I have time to talk about today, other than to thank you for listening. Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5, Nevada City, and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rewelistening.net.